Hello, I'm Smita Tharoor, and welcome to Stories of Unconscious Bias, a podcast where I ask guests from around the world to share their story and to reflect on their life experiences with unconscious bias. I hope you enjoy listening. They were recorded globally under COVID-19 lockdown conditions. Welcome, listeners. I'm very privileged to have a very interesting and unusual person to have a conversation on the unconscious bias. I'd like to introduce Nandita Das. Nandita is an actor and film director. She has acted in more than 40 films, both internationally and in India, in 10 different languages. She has also had her second directorial film, Manto, premiered in 2018 at the Cannes Film Festival. She was conferred the Knight of the Order of Arts and Letters by the French government, which is one of the highest honors the French give civilians, and was also the first Indian to be inducted into the Hall of Fame at the International Women's Forum. In 2014, she was selected as a World Yale Fellow. If that's not enough, Nandita is a strong advocate for social justice and human rights, and has been passionately supporting the campaign against color bias called Dark is Beautiful, which she then relaunched as India's Got Color in 2019. And guess what? There's still more. She is now a writer, and her first book, Manto and I, chronicles her six-year-long journey of making the film. And that's available if you want to buy it on Amazon, Flipkart, and if you're in India, in bookstores in India. Welcome, Nandita, and thank you so much for joining this conversation on the unconscious bias.
Thank you, Smita. It's a pleasure.
So, Nandita, tell me, unconscious bias, what do you understand by that?
One, I think that we all have it. It's about how we see people and perceive reality. I think our worldview is shaped by values, perceptions, you know, our assumptions, our expectations. And all of that are informed by our life experiences. So I think I would say unconscious bias, as the word suggests, are biases that we ourselves are not even aware of, but they do exist.
Absolutely. You're so right. And it could be positive or it could be negative. And I love the fact that you talked about values and upbringing and so on, because when I first started researching and working with the subject, I was looking back on my upbringing, and I realized that I was very, very lucky, because I was brought up with a strong sense of values, which was about acceptance and inclusivity, and a very liberal sense of looking at the world, whether it was religion or race or caste, right, or gender for that matter, growing up in India. But you don't, you just take it for granted, don't you? You don't think any differently. But tell
because
me some
that's,
more.
That's your real, I mean, that's your natural self, right? That upbringing is your normal self. So even I had a similar upbringing. Both my parents, my father is a painter, my mother is a writer. And, you know, I and my brother, we grow up with so much of freedom to question, freedom to think, freedom to make choices. It was very inclusive. People of all kinds, types, you know, across race, religion, country, gender, you know, there were no judgments. We were only told that you choose your friends dependent on, you know, how kind they are, how fun they are, how are they as human beings. And none of these other markers played any role. And I'm so grateful for that upbringing, because that's something that really goes deeper than any education that you can get, because then that becomes your normal self. You don't have to work hard at it too much. Of course, it's a lifelong journey. You have to work on your own prejudices and biases. But largely, if your upbringing is right, I think it just allows you to look at life in a different way.
Gosh, yes, exactly. And we are lucky. You are lucky and I'm lucky.
Totally.
When we're talking about freedom and privileges, we're not talking about wealth and travel or any of those things.
It is just
good, strong values. And that's what I loved. Yeah. The choice of words that you said when you talked about how we perceive without realizing. So tell us a little bit more, Nandita. Share some stories with us on what that looked like and felt like.
You mean in my childhood or just over the years?
Well, whenever,
my childhood, for once, like very late in life, I realized that men are expected, or at least in our kind of patriarchal traditional society, the roles that are assigned to men and women are so stereotyped in some sense, right? I mean, we expect men to be the breadwinner, the woman to be the homemaker and all of that. But as a child, my mother used to do a 9-to-5 job at National Book Trust. So she would go literally in the morning, come back in the evening, and my father would cook and clean, and I thought for recreation, painted. So I had this complete role reversal for the longest time, when I actually thought that's what fathers do, and, you know, this is what mothers do. Till, of course, the root shock came that mine was different, and usually it's just the opposite. So in some ways, I think that also was very important in the way I looked at gender roles, in the way, my engagement with gender issues came in later. It was after I did my master's in social work and I was working with NGOs. But because I had already experienced this, there was no reason in my mind for me to stereotype how men should behave or how women should, and whether work is more connected to men, or, you know, earning wasn't the main thing. In our family, money and work were never really connected. We, in fact, almost thought that it's bad. Money is a bad word, that you're not supposed to work for money. And so the whole, I think that perception that you grow up with definitely creates the foundation of your perceptions going forward. Then, of course, you are introduced to so many different aspects in life, and slowly your biases do start coming out. You see other people's biases, that makes you also aware of your own biases. And then the more aware you are over the years, the more you catch yourself, I think, the more you grapple with them, the more they disturb you, the more hope there is for you.
Yes, so there are a few things there you've said, Nandita, and I want to go back slightly to the earlier part of what you just said, which was about when you completed your master's in social work. Clearly, the first question I would ask is why? Firstly, what kind of influences did you have that you felt you wanted to work within that area? Was there some sort of other narrative, other unconscious bias that may have been influencing you? And secondly, but kind of connected, what kind of stories can you share when you began to work within that area?
You know, luckily my parents never told me that you have to become this or do this or this is my dream for you or any of those conversations. I did my bachelor's degree in geography, and my parents just asked me why geography, and I said, well, because I like the subject. And there wasn't a second question after that. I mean, what will you do with geography was never asked. Of course, every time I said that, you know, others would always roll their eyes and say, geography? I mean, why would you even take that? And at the end of those 3 years, I didn't want to do geography anymore. So here I was. And by then, I was quite disillusioned with also the educational system in college. I went to a very nice school. I had great memories of the school. But somehow in college, I felt it sort of killed my interest in studies. And I said, I don't want to study anymore. And my parents were kind of surprised. My father, I don't think, cared much about that. But my mother, who had done her MA in Sanskrit and PhD in, you know, scientific temper and in traditional folk art, etc., she said, you must do a master's. And I said, well, I don't know what to do it in, because I know I don't want to do geography, but I don't know what else to do. So let me take a year off. So I took a year off and I taught in this lovely school called Rishi Valley in the south, which was started by Jay Krishnamurti. So I wrote to them and, you know, I just taught there for 4 months, one term to the fifth grade. Pretty much everything except maths. I didn't feel equipped to do that. And it was after that I realized that I enjoy working with people. I wanted to study something that had less to do with academics and more to actually, you know, interact with people, to do something where I could engage with people. And that's when I didn't even know there was something called Masters in Social Work. I, in fact, applied for sociology. And then when I got to know there was something called MSW, and there was a place called Delhi School of Social Work, that, and of course, I'm talking about this many years ago, many decades ago, almost 30 years ago. That is when I did my Masters in Social Work. And I don't think that a degree makes you better or worse social worker. But it definitely exposes you to many different realities. And for that, I'm definitely very grateful, because, we all live in silos and we all think this is our world. And while I was exposed to a lot of the arts, as in music and dance and theater and exhibitions and the world of books, thanks to my mother, but there was really no real connection to other social realities. I did street theater though before that, during my graduation with a group called Jannatya Manch, which was started by Safdar Hashmi, who was later brutally killed. In fact, I was in Rishi Valley at that time when he was brutally killed while performing. But those 4 years with him and the group were also great influences in my life. It was, I call it my political training. That's the first time that I was introduced to the politics of economics, the politics of gender, the politics of, you know, haves and the have-nots, the working class, all of that. So in some ways it was, I would say, Jannatya Manch, then the MSW, and then of course working with various organizations. And I remember I went to, I was working with an organization called Ankur. I interned there, I did my field work there while studying. And then once I passed out, I wanted to join them as a full-time employee, and they were also happy to have me. And I suddenly became sort of the community head for that organization, the same place where I was earlier more like an intern. So it created a different kind of a balance within the team, and I wanted to be really democratic. And I was very, you know, you're 20, you're sort of feisty, and you think you're changing the world. So I would go and work with the community women. And I can never forget that this woman, she came to me, and I went to that basti, as we call it, the community, the slum, or, you know, the area that I was working in. And I saw this woman who was such a strong voice in our group. She was all black and blue and bruised. And I asked her, I said, "What happened to you?" And she said, "Oh, don't worry. My husband beat me up. But, you know, I'm going to do what I want to do, and I'm going to work, and he can't stop me." And she was all sort of angry and still ready to fight. And I realized that I had no idea what it was to live there. It's one thing to be going there with your, you know, all the education that you've had, all the understanding that the books have given you and your little experience, but you have no idea what it is to live in those circumstances and to be sort of living with your perpetrator in some sense. And, you know, it's not enough to be sort of all empowered and feisty when the man is still not asking those right questions or not responding in the way he ought to be. And I, in fact, decided to stop working in Ankur because I felt that I just wasn't capable of handling this. So it was a very moving experience for me. But, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's really connected to bias, but this idea of that I'm educated and I can go and make them all feisty. I've had this great background where I've been so empowered and I'm, you know, so confident, and, you know, I'm going to instill confidence in them without understanding the whole milieu and without being enough aware of those circumstances. And I think that was something that has always bothered me, that maybe I went too fast and I was too brash in the way I dealt with. And even though the woman didn't, you know, was happy that we were interacting and that she was feeling stronger, but I really didn't have a solution for her. I couldn't take her children and her to my house and say, "Okay, you know, just get out, just walk out of that marriage. He can't." So I was livid, but I was also, I remember sort of breaking down when I was hearing her story.
Well, that's just extremely powerful, Nandita. And thank you for sharing that with such honesty, because of course it's connected to bias, because if you think about our own unconscious biases, yeah. You've so well said, you know, you were brought up in a different kind of bubble, which was inclusive and liberal and accepting and creative and all of those. But the real world, which is a different kind of real world, your real world didn't include families who did not have much money, or families who were, you know, women who were being beaten up by their husbands or living under very extreme poverty conditions. And it's when you allowed yourself to get into those situations that you realized you had very little knowledge about that. So in a strange sort of way, it was of help to you, wasn't it? Even though you had the courage to leave, it still helped you grow and begin to understand more about the world.
Absolutely. And that, you know, while you can empathize, you cannot, when we say we put ourselves in somebody's shoes. And it's very difficult to do that. And I think that awareness came fairly early, that you may think that what the other is feeling, you know it, but you really don't know it because you really haven't experienced it. And that's the deepening that you have to do over the years and with your own self, where you slowly start understanding what the other is feeling, whether it's going to be 100% or 80% or 90%, but you become closer to that feeling. You don't come with that judgment or that confidence that, oh, I understand what you're going through, because you don't. And just that humility and awareness is very, very important.
In fact, often people say, don't they, that which I don't agree with, is that treat other people the way you want to be treated. Well, actually, no, not really. Treat other people the way they want to be treated. And if you have no clue how they want to be treated, then you need to ask.
Well, it depends. Yeah, it depends on the situation as well. But like you had initially said that, you know, growing up in the kind of liberal environment you and I grew up, that in itself is privilege. We use the word privilege so much for just class and wealth and all of that, which is a privilege, no question about that. But even the privilege to think independently, the privilege to have that kind of confidence, privilege to ask questions, you know, privilege to just make choices freely. I think those are enormous privileges too, which we take for granted. I mean, I remember later in my year, later, you know, after I got into acting and I started getting a lot of these invites to colleges, and I would speak to these young people, and I would, in my initial years, I would say that, you know, follow your heart, do what you really want to do, what you love doing. And I remember one girl once raised her hand and she said, but ma'am, I don't know what I want to do. I don't know what I love. I've never had the opportunity to even explore what I really love doing. And that's when it hit me that, my God, I've taken my those privileges for granted and assume that everybody has a passion, that you work what you're passionate about, you know. We used to think about you do what you love and you love what you do, and that's so simple. And then you suddenly realize that that's a huge privilege. And by just assuming that everybody can do that or has the opportunity to do that, you're actually clueless about the realities that exist beyond your life, or you're not, you know, cognizant of what others go through and how our education system, how our familial structure is constantly just telling you to get a job, to in fact not do other things. You're wasting time painting. That's a hobby, and you know. So it's that constant onslaught. You're up against that, and I think she really opened my eyes when she said that I don't even know what I love doing. So how do I follow my heart?
Yes, just one sentence, and we learn so much from that. So very true.
And that's why these things stay with you. The reason they come back, even in a conversation like this, after so many years, is because you know that something shifted in you. And I think that's how we also grow, right? That's how we realize that our responses, I mean, even though I feel like my core values and how I think, deep inside is the same, maybe for the last 30 years, but I know I'm not the same. And you know it only because you respond to those situations and those things in different ways now than probably one did earlier. And it's a work in progress anyway, so.
Of course, exactly. But so you went from social work and then acting. Well, hello, what's the connection and why and how? I mean, yes, you mentioned. No connection, and you followed your heart. And I've seen you in many films, and that's why I'm so excited to be able to have this conversation with you. Your early films, you know, things like Fire and so on, and of course more recently as well. But acting and then directing. So tell us stories about those. Any kind of stories you might have learnt from or experienced in terms of unconscious bias, either from your side or from perhaps within the acting industry.
So I got into acting completely by accident. I met Deepa Mehta through a friend, and I totally didn't want to act. Even when I was doing street theatre, and Safdar would always tell me, you should take acting seriously. And I would say, no, it's just fun. I like doing it, but definitely not as a profession. And Fire, because it was my first film, at that time I didn't even know there was going to be a second film. So when people said, oh, you were so courageous to do that as a first film, I was like, you know, I just did it because it was an interesting subject, something that even in my liberal family, we never really talked about homosexuality. There was no judgment. You know, there were people of various sexual orientation that were part of our world, but we never really talked about it. So after I did the film, it was not even during the film that major changes happened or that I was dealing with, you know, different feedback. It was after the film, there was a range of questions and comments that, you know, I experienced both from the media, from audiences, from friends, family, from people loving the film to people hating it, to people just being uncomfortable with it. And I remember very early on when somebody would say, well, are you a lesbian? And I would completely sort of, you know, become very defensive and say, no, I'm not. But why can't I, even as a straight person, do a role of a lesbian? You know, you never ask that when you, when somebody does a different role of a queen or of a popper or whatever. Why am I being asked? And there was this discomfort I would feel like as if I had to tell that, no, I'm not a lesbian. You know, today, if the same question was asked, I would be, you know, totally relaxed. And I would say, that's none of your business. You know, you are, whether I am or not, is got nothing to do with my performance and the film. And, you know, like sometimes even today people ask it, well, you're straight and why are you supporting these issues of homosexuality and, you know, LGBTQ rights? And I say, well, because this is a human rights issue and I care about it as much as I don't have to be a lesbian to be supporting it. I'm a human being. And, you know, if people are being discriminated against, it's something that deeply bothers me. So there were a lot of these, I mean, I was shocked how much of these unconscious and conscious bias that came out during that time from the best of people, quote unquote, very liberal, modern, seemingly modern people who would completely be shocked that, you know, a film like Fire was had been shown or that I could act in it. I would be sitting on a flight where an unknown person, a stranger next to me would say that, you know, I mean, the film was interesting, but I don't think you've done something right by doing that film because you're going to make everyone lesbians. I was like, really? In 2 hours, I'm going to make everyone lesbians? By that logic, all our stories are about kings and queens. Then there shouldn't be any lesbians and gays, you know, if that's the only way people become. So at that time, I got really aware of this whole phenomena of othering, that how quick we are with our biases and prejudices, how quick we are with our judgments, how much we fear the unknown, how little do we know about the other. And, you know, so many of these issues that I still am engaged with and I feel passionately about, I feel the seeds of that was sown then. And thanks to Fire and the conversations and interactions that I had with various people after that, you know, I think made a huge impact on me in the way I processed this whole phenomena of othering. The other big issue that, again, has come into my life by default is the bias against skin color. And, you know, growing up as a dark person in this country, there's no escape anyway. Like somebody or the other. Thankfully, my parents never talked about it. In fact, they never even talked about how I looked. Somehow, how you look was not really a point of conversation. Even if something, like if you're looking nice, it was more about the sari and where it was, you know, woven and, you know, things like that, but never really about how you look. So I was saved from that perception. But growing up as a dark person, there's always an aunt or a friend or somebody who's kind of telling you, oh, you should put turmeric on your face. Don't go out in the sun. Have you tried this cream? And, you know, things like that. When I came into the film industry, and like I said, by default, I made all the choices in the films that I wanted to because it was, I didn't see it as a profession. Strangely, I still don't see it as a profession, but more of an interest. I did not really have to go through the struggle that many young actors go through of, you know, going to directors, asking for roles, trying out different things, auditioning. I didn't have to do any of that. But I remember that when I would do, you know, slum dweller, a villager, a lower caste woman, it was great. If I didn't put any makeup, it was totally fine. But the minute I would do a role of an educated woman, an upper class or a, you know, somebody like an urban affluent person, I would immediately be told either by the director or the camera person or the makeup person that I know you don't like to lighten your skin, but just for this, could you, because this is an educated urban character. And I didn't understand what that meant. You're telling, you're casting a dark-skinned woman who is an urban person, who is educated, you know, who's middle class, upper middle class, whatever we call ourselves. And you're telling me that you want to stereotype and make everybody light-skinned because that is the perception and you want to just play to that. So I would have lots of arguments and I would tell them that this is wrong casting, then please don't take me, I'm fine. And sometimes it has happened. Most often they've kind of said, yeah, no, you're right, but you see, the audience expects you to be lighter, just a little bit lighter, etc. But sometimes it has even happened that I have done the film and when I actually watch the film later, in post-production, they have lightened me. And and I feel that's a real violation. That after having all those conversations, after me categorically saying, you know, this is not how I want to look. I mean, you have one chance of also showing women of different colors in different class. You know, why are we stereotyping and further creating those perceptions? And yet, in fact, even articles that have talked about this campaign that I started supporting in 2013 called Dark is Beautiful, they would write the article about this, but they would lighten my photograph by about 3 or 4 shades. And they would almost do it as if they were doing me a favor by lightening me, because then, you know, it's such a euphemism for beautiful. It's, you know, it's always juxtaposed. It's the same thing for many. To be light-skinned and to be beautiful is the same thing. So they would often do that. And that's why in 2013, when this organization called Women of Worth, it's a Chennai-based organization, when they reached out to me to, you know, sort of join the campaign, and they said, could you give us a photo and a quote? And I said, sure, I'll give you a photo and a quote. It's an important issue. I don't think it's one of the core issues that I want to engage with, because I was, you know, at that time working on women's issues in terms of opportunities, in terms of female feticide and domestic violence. And those issues seemed so much bigger than the color of your skin, especially if it hasn't played a very significant role in your own life. I know that's all I did. I didn't even engage with it. But before I knew it, went completely viral and so many people started talking about it that by default, I became the face of the campaign. And also probably because most actors with every film have become lighter and lighter. Like most of the popular big actors that you see, or not even the big ones across board, if you see with every film, their skin has become lighter and lighter, whether it's because of the demand of the producers, who say it's the demand of the audience, or we don't know, it's a chicken and egg situation. But I didn't really start out to champion this cause and didn't see it as a standalone issue. I had talked about it in many of my talks, but as one of the many things that we are subjected to as women. But I slowly started realizing that it totally merited a standalone attention, because so many young girls and women and even boys were suffering because of this very, very deep-rooted bias. And this is one of those biases which has almost got legitimacy. It's not even uncool, or it's not even wrong to be talking about the color of your skin. I mean, every matrimonial ad is full of that, you know, fair and lovely and convent-educated, homely. Those things haven't changed in 30 years that I've sort of read them now more for, you know, humor. But it is such a deep bias and people are so open about it that my own awareness about it has grown so much more than I really began with.
This is so important, Nandita. I'm so grateful for you to share this, because things like, you know, the infanticide and women battering and all the other areas that are all extremely important and valuable for you to support, there will be many people supporting it along with you. But something as simple as just color of skin, people don't even realize how much it affects the psyche of a human being, men and women. And thank you for sharing that. And how it continues, certainly in India alone, as an example. I mean, for those of the listeners who are of Indian origin, or sorry, who are living in India, they may bank with a bank called ICICI Bank, as I do. And I remember, I'm talking about 2 years ago, I got an email from ICICI Bank during budget time talking about whatever they were talking about. And there was a picture of four people. And this was entrepreneur, student, salaried employee, and homemaker. Now, no marks for guessing vendors of these four. That's a given. But what a lot of people didn't notice was that they were just hand-drawn pictures. They were, you know, just they were not photographs. And they didn't even have a mouth or a nose or any of that. They were just faces. Oh, like, there were three, three blank faces, male faces, brown-colored skin faces for the salaried employee, the entrepreneur, and the student. And the homemaker, obviously woman, but color of skin, Caucasian. I'm talking about white, not brown, with bright red lipstick. God. The only one who had a mouth. And the irony is the chief executive of ICICI Bank at that time was a woman. So it was like, for crying out loud, obviously she wouldn't have approved it. I'm not holding her responsible. But I'm just saying, and without realizing it, this is the power of unconscious bias. Without realizing it, all of us ICICI bank holders, bank account holders, would have got this email, would have looked at that picture and wouldn't even have noticed it. They would have read the words and that it would have just got embedded in their psyche that obviously it has to be a white-skinned, beautiful woman to be the homemaker. And the white skin bit is the point I'm flagging up for this conversation. So the fact that you are supporting and advising and making sure that people in this country, in India, are aware of unconscious bias and how much it affects the individual, I think is very important. And the irony is, the listeners around the world will say, hang on a minute, we're not just talking about India. It could be somebody sitting in Nigeria. It could be somebody sitting in, I don't know, anywhere. There are so many different parts of the world.
South America and, you know, everywhere, actually. Because now when you see even the biggest brands have a whole whitening line. Even the European brands and the Southeast Asian brands, they all have a whitening line. And so many young women have come up to me and said that, thank you for doing this campaign. You know, it makes me feel better about myself. People have shared their stories, which have been really heartbreaking, where women have not even, like, for instance, there was a young girl who really wanted to do theater. She said, you know, I used to act all the time at home. But when I went to school and when they asked who all want to sign up for it, I didn't, because I knew I would never get the main part. So, and I didn't want to be standing in the fifth row. And I knew they wouldn't even audition me. So many women, in fact, didn't grow and didn't do all the things they wanted to do and crush their dreams because they knew there would be a natural exclusion. And I have heard horrific stories of women wanting to commit suicide because they couldn't keep their parents happy because they couldn't become, you know, lighter skin, couldn't become white, as they say, or couldn't become fair, that they really tried hard with all these creams, but they couldn't, so they wanted to kill themselves. I mean, the number of stories I've heard after that, I realized how wrong I was to think that this was one of the many issues and it didn't probably merit a standalone attention. In fact, it should have come 50 years, you know, it already came 50 years too late. But in 2019, which was last year, the same organization reached out to me saying, our campaign is now 10-year-old and there have been many achievements, like, for instance, the ad agencies, and they started becoming more careful about it. There is an ad council that creates the rules and regulations for ads. They banned saying the word fair. So, of course, there are other ways in which people, you know, find ways to beat the system. But overall, there were changes and perceptions were changing, and they could see that. But they wanted to do something special in 2019 to celebrate the 10 years. I always was a little uncomfortable with the campaign name, which is Dark is Beautiful. I felt it put too much of emphasis both on beauty and the fact that you're dark. And it kind of, you know, reiterated maybe that idea. So the fact that I got an opportunity to change the name, I asked them if I could call it India's Got Colour. Anyway, diversity in our country at many levels is being threatened right now and for several years now. So I thought this would be quite apt. One, it doesn't only talk about dark women, because, you know, what is dark? It's so relative. I've had people come up to me and say, ma'am, you're not dark. You know, you are much lighter than me. You have no idea what I go through. And, you know, especially in colleges. And I do a lot of conversations with young people. So I think I felt that if we talked about India's got color, then you're celebrating every color. You're just saying that every color is fine. Just be yourself and be comfortable in your skin. And that really was the message. And I called up various actors, you know, Swara Bhaskar and Radhika Apte and Ratna Pathak Shah and Ali Fazal and, you know, a whole lot of Vikrant Messi, Tilottama Shom, a bunch of amazing actors who didn't even see the script. I called them up and said, I want to do a 2-minute video to talk about this. And, you know, we can do a fun video that triggers these conversations. And they all came, and they all, as actors, had suffered, women much more. And they told me all these horrific stories, how they are constantly being told to lighten, especially in the more mainstream cinema. And you know, sometimes even told to do plastic surgery. And that's huge. Nowadays, it's really big. People are getting lasers, and not just actors, just regular people, and more so women are, you know, going through so many hormonal and other physical changes and having all kinds of medicines and injecting all kinds of things just to be light-skinned. And it's sad in a country which is 80% probably my color is made to feel that you're just not good enough. So I think it's a real tragedy, and it needs to be taken more seriously than we do, because all our images, whether it's on hoardings, whether it's in films, whether it's on television, our magazines, everywhere you see lights, even bank information, exactly. Everywhere you see, you know, women with lighter skin, and it just reinforces that these women don't have to really represent us. They have to be what we should aspire to be. And that's such a dangerous phenomena.
Absolutely. And I'm sure the listeners are very grateful that you are flying this up. Firstly, for those listeners who are in India, do check it out. Do learn more about the stuff that Nandita is doing and supporting, you know, the people.
Yeah, the little video is on YouTube as well. And you can look up also Women of Worth, the Chennai-based organization, because they are doing a lot of educational work and other things, other campaigns. You know, as part of the campaign, they're doing various activities to create more conversations around this.
Brilliant. So Nandita, top tips. What can you advise us? What kind of learning have you taken away from all these experiences? How do we manage our unconscious biases?
I guess the fact it's unconscious, you can't specifically do anything when it pops up. But if we are more mindful, we will always be able to see it, sometimes in the moment. And sometimes soon after, sometimes days after. But as long as we train our mind to be watchful and to be unsparing, we will become more aware. And the more aware you become, you slowly change it. Because so much of it is just conditioning. And because it's unconscious, one doesn't realize it. You know, it just kicks in. It's like a knee-jerk reaction. But if you are mindful about it, if you talk about it with your friends, you know, when you point out, because we are all able to see each other's biases, unconscious biases, very clearly. It's just that we don't see our own. So I think even in seeing others, like you've asked me, what are mine? You know, so when, you know, some of it is like the corporate world. I was married to a corporate man, and I remember when he was sort of emailing me and writing to me and all of that in the beginning, some friend had introduced us, and I was not even responding because I thought, oh, he's one of those typical corporate people. I don't even want to meet him. Like, what will I talk with him about? And, you know, because I grew up in this kind of an environment where corporates were seen as sharks. Some of it is true, but that's not the whole truth. So to be able to see people as individuals is important. So we all have those biases of certain regions, and you know, people from Gujarat are like this, or Punjabis are like this, or Tamilians are like this. You know, we have those biases about things. And of course, some of it comes from certain generalizations, have a kernel of truth, but it's definitely not the whole truth. And when you block your mind, when you actually do not see people for who they are, and you already have a perception in mind, you're actually, you're doing a disservice to yourself, because you're not allowing yourself to experience new things. You're not allowing, to see people in the way they actually are. And I think that block would harm you, your own relationship with people. So if we are just more mindful, we will definitely catch ourselves, whether immediately or later. And it's a constant process. You can never say that, oh, I've arrived and I have no more unconscious bias. It's an ongoing process, and you will find new unconscious biases popping up just when you thought you had dealt with one. So yeah, I think it's just a training that we have to do to ourselves.
To keep at it. Brilliant, yes. Absolutely brilliant. Wise words. Nandita Das, thank you so very
thank
much.
Thank you so much for giving us your time these things on this. And giving me the opportunity to also think about this. And these are also reminders, you know. So next time when I'm in that moment, I think I will remember our conversation and catch myself sooner.
Thank you again. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Stories of Unconscious Bias with me, Smita Tharoor. Stay tuned for the next interview in a week's time. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter for updates on my episodes @SmitaTharoor.